सतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय ॐ असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर् वासतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो ज्योति
I'd like to welcome you with love to this fourth class in our deep practice for radical times. Prolonged conversation on the practices and philosophy of the Yoga Sutra. So let's plunge in right away by finding ourselves seated around the magical lake, Lake Manasarovar, the great lake of consciousness, and find yourself, feel yourself seated high in the Himalayan mountains. There's snow-capped peaks all around you. All of us are here. Those of us who are physically on this call, and those of us who are listening to the call at a later time. And as we've been doing for the last few weeks, you can also invite or bring in some of the people in your life whom you'd like to feel blessed by this practice. Find your posture and, of course, use the breathing, the magical power of prana. Inhaling so that the base of the posture becomes heavy and grounded and sinks into the seat. Exhaling with the feeling that the torso lifts up with the exhalation, up through the crown. And you can bring your awareness into the heart, into the region behind the chest. And I'm going to suggest that you place your hand over the center of your chest, your right hand with the left hand on top of it. And begin to become present to the connection between your palm and this subtle region of the heart. As you feel the pulse of the heartbeat. And again, I'm going to ask that those of you who are able and who feel inclined actually make a cup of your hands, holding your cupped hands right in front of your heart. Imagine a candle in your palms and place into the candle flame, which you have lit with the magical flame coming out of your fingertips. Imagine in the candle flame, an open space where you can place the highest and most compassionate intention that you can find at this moment. An intention for your own practice, an intention for the safety of the people all over the world who are in so many ways being squeezed and contracted and who are physically, economically, emotionally suffering. Perhaps you can include an intention for their well-being, for the well-being of the people that you know and love, for your own well-being. And with that intention, place the candle in the lake. And become aware of the flames of all of our candles floating in the lake. And I'm going to speak the intention that I hold for all of us for our time together in the class. May our practice uplift us. May it carry us farther in our journey of enlightenment. May it give us wisdom, comfort, and peace in this difficult time. May it enable us to be of help to others, both those that our lives directly impact and all those whom our thoughts touch. And may all beings benefit from what we're doing here together. And we'll chant the opening invocations, starting with three Oms, then the invocation to Shiva as the Eternal Teacher,
the invocation to the primordial goddess, and the traditional Patanjali invocation mantras.
Shivaya Gurave Sat Chit Ananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayane Namostute. Vande Gurunam Charana Ravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhava Bodhe Nishreyase Jangali Kayamane Samsara Hala Halamoha Shantyai Abahu Purushakaram Shankha Chakra Siddharinam Sahasra Shirasam Shvetam Paranamami Patanjalim Paranamami Patanjalim Paranamami Patanjalim.
Your eyes are closed, your upper eyelids resting softly on the lower eyelids. And we'll just spend a few moments allowing the breath to sweep through the body. So inhaling, have the feeling that the breath flows up from the soles of your feet, up through your calves, up through your knees and thighs, up through your pelvic area, rising through the torso, through the chest, through the throat, through the head, and out the crown of the head. And then feel that the breath flows downward from the crown down to the soles of the feet. The inhalation in this particular breath flowing upward through all these parts of the body and then flowing downward from the crown to the feet. And once again, inhaling with the sense that the breath flows upward from the feet, from through the ankles, the knees, through the legs, through the torso, through the chest, up through the crown, pauses for a moment above the crown, and then sweeps downward through the feet. One more time. Inhaling from the feet, through the calves, the knees, the thighs, up into the torso, rising through the lower abdomen, the middle of the torso, up through the chest, the neck, the head. And then feel with the exhalation that energy from the solar regions above the crown actually flows down through the crown, irradiating your head, your neck, your torso, flowing all the way down your legs to your feet. And as you inhale and exhale with a gentle, natural breath, begin to have the sense of your body as a vessel of light, as though subtle sunlight has entered your body through the crown and is flowing through every part of you. Meditate on the feeling of light within the body, light that can be experienced as a visual luminosity or as a sense of lightness and clarity. And as you allow your attention to be present in the body, noticing which parts of the body you're most inclined to dwell in, feel that the light of the subtle sun, the light of consciousness itself, is at this moment filling your body with wisdom, with love, and with an openness that can live in every cell and breathe life force in through your pores so that you're energized, literally enlightened by the prana shakti that flows from the sun and through every particle of the air. In this class, we're going to be doing actually quite a lot of practice. This is essentially a meditation and pranayama class. As you may have noticed, our classes so far have kind of segued between yogic information and yogic practice. And as we're beginning to see, if we didn't know it already, the Yoga Sutras is a true compendium of yoga sadhana. And particularly this chapter, the first book of the Yoga Sutra, which is called Samadhipada, literally meaning the book on absorption. But as the commentators make clear, samadhi, though we think of it as being an extremely esoteric and advanced state, which of course it is, but samadhi is at heart an intense state of concentration. So in Raja Yoga, which is the yoga that the Yoga Sutra is a part of. Raja Yoga being the so-called royal yoga, which is essentially the practice of opening the mind, the subtle body, through meditation and concentration, and ultimately anchoring the mind in its source, which is way beyond anything that the ordinary mind can conceive, but which is so much a part of us that as we begin to allow the obstacles and kleshas, the fundamental afflictions, to dissolve, we start to realize that we are already that expanded, light-filled mind, and that even the density of our physical body is also irradiated with that subtle light and space. And I have to say that a lot of the emphasis in Raja Yoga is on honing our ability to concentrate, whether on external objects or internal states. And I find it extremely helpful in my personal life, and I think for all of us, because as a society, we suffer from a kind of collective attention deficit disorder. And so practices of concentration are challenging for us, for many of us, but also extremely helpful. because the problem of broken concentration existed long before we had all these devices, long before we lived in cities, long before we faced a world of information overload, and you know, and long before the vehicles for knowing the truth of things had become so distorted and difficult to follow. Our internal obstacles, like disease and doubt and their cousins, actually permeate our societies, especially now, of course. They've been with us forever, and they have roots in every part of us, in the entire psychophysical system. So in order to address these obstacles, which don't only distort our meditation, they actually distort every part of our lives, as you know, we need to work with the entire psychic organism, the mind and heart, and also with the body. So the four antidotes that we've been practicing with this week, Maitri, the feeling of friendliness, Karuna, the feeling of compassion, Mudita, the feeling of sympathetic joy, and Upeka, equanimity or neutrality, they're really helpful right now, as many of you have been noticing. They help us cure the negative attitudes that everyone falls into from time to time and which are pretty much at the surface in this extremely fraught period. So the antidotes are essentially emotional practices for shifting the feeling states that cause our daily suffering. They are also ways of practicing enlightenment. And it's important to recognize as you practice these that at some point, if it hasn't happened already, you'll get a felt experience of what the enlightened quality that you're practicing actually means. And I want to share an experience of my first experience of what real compassion is, which happened in the late 90s. I was on a solo pilgrimage in South India, and I just spent about 24 hours in the Chidambaram temple, which is one of the great Shaiva temples of South India. It's the home of a form of Shiva, which is known as the Akasha Linga. It's an icon that is in which there's no form. It's just space. And it's amazingly enough, when you stand in front of this particular space in the temple, the spiritual power that emanates from it nearly knocks you over. It's so strong. So I had been meditating there, and I was feeling a lot of spiritual power that had come from practicing in the temple. And as I came to continue my journey, I met the driver of the car I was traveling in. I asked him how he was doing, and he said, "Oh, madam, too many mosquito bites." And as he said it, I could feel his body, which was literally aflame with mosquito bites. He'd slept in the car and, you know, just been bitten on every part of his body. And I could feel them in my body. And yet, with the feeling of, you know, itching and burning, there was also an underlying ecstasy. So as we drove off down this country road where it was harvest time. There were a lot of grains being harvested, and they were piled in the middle of the road, people kind of beating them and threshing them and as we drove around them. And I could actually feel the muscles of the people who were working and the sweat on their bodies and the heat of the sun and the tiredness and also the enthusiasm in these people. And as I did, as I entered into their experience, I realized that I had been gifted with a true experience of compassion. We could say the compassion that Shiva feels, because, as you know, Shiva is all of this, is in all of this, and according to tradition, feels all of this. But the interesting thing, the powerful thing about this experience was that even though I was feeling the quite profound physical discomfort and suffering of the people and beings that I was coming across, many of them, not all of them, obviously, but there was not a sense of suffering. There was instead a feeling of incredible ecstasy. And that was the moment when I began to understand, and I literally wept for the next hour as I stayed in this state, which eventually dissolved. I realized that what compassion means, you know, the literal translation of the Latinate word is to suffer with or to feel with. It's real compassion is not about entering into people's suffering. It's about feeling your non-difference from them, therefore naturally experiencing what they're experiencing, but underlaid with joy, with ecstasy, because that is the divine state of which compassion is one expression. So we could say that the sages reverse engineered the states that we experience as we evolve spiritually and given us these practices like loving kindness or extending our awareness to include others, which can start to give us some practice and some, maybe a taste or two of what will be downloaded into us as a completely open heart in those moments when we are experiencing enlightened consciousness. And may this be our experience, all of us, all the time, at this moment and forever, even when we forget it, even when we lose it. Know that it's there, it's present, it's drawing us, and it is what we really are. So in the next sutra, Sutra 34, we begin to open to the extraordinary power of prana shakti, which every yoga tradition will tell us is the true foundation of the purificatory practices that we do to eliminate the obstacles. And we're gonna return to pranayama over and over again in the course of the Yoga Sutras. It's such a profound aspect of yoga, and it's so central to our psychophysical life, because it is literally the form of the primordial shakti that interfaces between the subtlest levels of reality and the physical world. Prana is the power that keeps us alive. In Tantra, which is, of course, based on the experience of self-realized sages, the body is understood to be the vehicle through which the great shakti manifested in order to be able to experience this physical world, as I was having that experience of the mosquito bites in my driver's body. Shakti has the experience of our pleasure and pain through our bodies as expressions of her. So prana is the connective force that makes this possible, that links this absolute intelligence with the mind and body. And this is a tremendously mysterious idea, but essentially what it points out, and it's very much subject to experience once we begin to become conscious of these subtle aspects of ourselves, is that it is the prana through which shakti breathes us, keeps our heart beating, grows the embryo in the womb, grows plants and trees from seeds, and actually even births planets and stars. So prana, according to the sages of yoga and tantra, and actually of many traditions, is actually the form which spirit takes in the physical universe. And it not only is the vehicle that manifests the physical world, it is also the vehicle we ride to reunite ourselves with the source. So there are many different forms of prana, and the yogic scriptures list many, many of them. Supposedly there are 10 main forms of prana, or vayu, which means wind, in the body, and many more in the exterior world. Kundalini shakti is also an aspect of prana. And of course, in Chinese medicine, as well as in Ayurveda, several different kinds of prana are described in Chinese, in the traditional Chinese medical system, the different kinds of prana are described as qi, jing, and shen, which operate through the physical body, through the subtle body, and also as forms of spirit that operate through the heart. And the power of prana is that because it operates on all these levels forcefully, not passively, prana is actually it's an energetic force. It can harmonize all these aspects of our vehicles, and it's described in the Yoga Sutras as the most direct way there is to dissolve the veils that obscure our inner light. You know, we don't see the light that is our true being because it's so covered by the schmutz, including the samskaras, the vasanas, and we're going to get to this next week, I hope, the kleshas, the core afflictions which come together to keep us trapped in ignorance. And if you think samskaras and vasanas feel problematic, the kleshas can get you really depressed if you don't realize that you're on a path to eliminating them. So all of these create the veilings that block the light. Without the veil, every time you close your eyes, you'd see this blazing light that is your real nature, which underlies the organs, which interpenetrates them. And during those moments when our awareness is completely clear, we see that. You know, we actually can see the light that runs along with the blood through our veins and arteries, that underlies our heartbeat, that flows in and out of the body every time we take a breath. And it's because of this insight that the physical body is actually imbued with spirit through the prana, that yoga has evolved such a complete psychophysical system. You know, the path of Raja Yoga is essentially about the mind, but these sages knew the mind not just as a subtle faculty, but also as a substratum of the physical body. They recognized how at every level of practice, our relationship with prana is paramount. So just as sunshine, which is a form of prana, according to the sages, sunshine which can dissolve molds, viruses, bacteria, pranayama detoxifies our cells by burning accumulated impurities, and it can also be harnessed to directly dissolve the detritus of our accumulated samskaras. So in the Western alchemical tradition, it's said that the higher always acts upon the lower. So when we tune into higher energies, those higher energies automatically alchemize and open the denser parts of us, both physically and psycho-spiritually. So I think this is why Patanjali keeps returning again and again to the mystery of prana and the power of pranayama. It's in every chapter of the book, and in every chapter of the book, he takes it a little bit deeper. So I'm hoping that one of the things we fall in love with in this class, aside from our own self and each other, is pranayama. I personally have had a fairly fraught relationship with pranayama, mainly because I've had lifelong breathing problems, perhaps arising from some issues coming through the birth canal, as some people these days would say. But as a result, when I first began using or learning breath-focused meditation, I often would get into a slight panic because my inhalation wasn't really long enough, my exhalation wasn't really long enough, so I would often run out of oxygen mid-breath. So the thing that changed it for me was something I was told by a Tibetan teacher at a workshop I took fairly early in my practice. And I told him this problem I was having with breath practices, and he said, just forget who's breathing. Just forget who's breathing. What a simple thing. And it was so radical for me because what I saw in that moment was that it was my ego's identification with the act of breathing that was hanging me up. So the key to freeing the breath, and this is true even when we're doing a forceful pranayama, as I'll keep reminding you, is to recognize that breathing happens on its own, that it's a natural process, and that it is going to happen whether or not you're able to master a technique of proper breathing. That said, mastering proper breathing will utterly transform your health. So what we've come to know is that when we feel fearful when we're trying to do deliberate conscious breathing, it's really good to remember that you and I as individuals do not control the breathing process, even though we can. You know, the breath, as I know you know, because so many of you are yogis, is both an automatic process and a process that we can work with deliberately, which, if we work with it deliberately, will begin to change the way that the automatic practices are happening. In this class, we're going to explore Sutras 34, 35, and 36, which are three of the key practice sutras in this text, and to dive into a couple of pranayamas that are associated with them. I actually want to say that the reason I chose Pandit Rajmani's translation and commentary on the Yoga Sutras is because of the way he guides us through these three sutras, especially Sutra 36. His commentary focuses on a couple of practices from the Sri Vidya Tantric tradition, which is his tradition. And they're practices that are specifically designed to open the two chakras that Tantra, not just Sri Vidya Tantra, but also Shaiva Tantra, emphasize, which are the heart center and the center of the Ajna Chakra in the center of the head. Of course, we're practicing with these centers in our daily meditation, and many of you have done quite a bit of practice with these centers, both in this course and over the years of our sadhana. Ajna Chakra is actually one of the easiest centers to focus on in meditation, perhaps because most of us are centered in the brain and our head. The heart center, which for many of us is the natural place that we rest our awareness, is often harder to get into, partly because our hearts tend to be somewhat blocked by the emotional wounds that so many of us have sustained in the course of life. Very often the interpersonal affliction, so to speak, the wounds that come to us from our interactions with others and with the world, they tend to come in through the heart. And therefore, as we begin to practice with the heart center, there often is a period where we have to allow ourselves to experience the contractions, the energetic blocks that may be in the heart, and also to experience feelings coming up that are not always pleasant. This set of practices is meant to kind of open up the heart so that we can start to really take rest there. This week we're going to be making the practices a bit more targeted and intensifying them. And again, I want to say as we start that all of these sutras are based on yogic experiments. The yoga sages considered themselves scientists of the interior world, and they considered their practices to be lab experiments. Literally, the body in yoga is the laboratory within which we discover the practices that will really open us, and in which we actually learn the yogic science. We learn yogic science not just by hearing about it, but by experimenting with it, by playing with it. And for me as a practitioner, this understanding has been critical and profoundly empowering, because I had to learn that rather than sticking to a technique or practicing a technique with the kind of perfectionism and fear of doing it wrong, it was actually possible to take every technique as the instructions for repeating an experiment but also to tweak it according to my own experience. And this is something that I'm really hoping that all of us can do with these practices. It's important to master the preliminaries to try and get the instructions right. It's absolutely important. But at the same time, because this is Shakti-driven practice, because everything we do here is being empowered by the Shakti of our lineages and of the meta-lineage that all of us are a part of, we're going to be given insights and suggestions about how to work these practices. And it really is great to just give ourselves permission to kind of go off the track in moments when it feels as though we're being very strongly pulled into a part of the inner world, not to get pulled by the mind, not to get pulled by our doubts or speculations, but to get pulled by the hints and insights that the prana and the chitti shakti will give us as we do all these practices of opening these chakras. So here are the three sutras. I'm going to read them in English. Transparency of mind also comes by practicing pranayama that involves forceful exhalation and breath retention. Sutra 35, a unique cognition pertaining to a sense object arising from within also anchors the mind to the peaceful flow free from all thought constructs. And 36, by concentrating on the lotus of the heart, there also arises a state of sorrowless joy and light. By concentrating on this, the mind is stabilized in peace. So, obviously, these sutras all point to practices for helping to anchor the mind in states that allow us to sail past any obstructions that come up in meditation and also in life. So they follow from Sutra 33, which approaches the obstructions through cultivating higher attitudes. Sutra 34 supports these attitudes by bringing direct shakti into the body-mind through pranayama. And, you know, though we usually define pranayama as breath practice, the truth is that the word pranayama actually means harnessing subtle energy, harnessing prana. Prana, you know, is shakti in a very immediate sense. And using the breath to settle the mind, of course, has become the staple of all wellness practice. You know, in our time, the particular type of pranayama that this sutra points to, involving forceful inhalation and exhalation, has been the basis of a lot of contemporary practice for emotional and psychological release, including Stan Grof's holotropic breathwork, which is very popular, very, very famous, and has influenced a lot of people. The Wim Hof method, which is a little bit more casual, seems to start with a deep yogic ujjayi breath. The practices of people like David Elliott and Scott Schwenk, which are all intuitive expressions of the power of forceful inhalation and exhalation. And breathing in this way, the forceful inhalation and exhalation, is famous for its power to bring up and eliminate all sorts of emotional blocks. So I want to give us a moment to practice Kapalavati, which literally means the skull-shining practice, which I think many of you are familiar with. This is a practice that involves forceful inhalation and exhalation coming from the lower belly and the diaphragm. It's a terrific way of energizing your meditation. It's also a practice for literally bringing so much energy into the mind field that the obstructions dissolve. And one of my teachers said something that I found very, very helpful. She said that when you breathe from the belly, when you breathe from the lower belly, what you're actually doing is casting out a lot of the held in negative feelings that, you know, the second chakra, the third chakra are two places where we hold a lot of obstructive energy. And practicing Kapalabhati will actually allow us to, you know, to kind of clear it out. And it's helpful practice to do every day. We're just going to do it very briefly. And if you want to practice it on your own with instruction from someone whom you can actually see practicing it, I'm going to send you a link to a YouTube practice. It's a very light version of Kapalabhati taught by a teacher from Yogi Bhajan's Kundalini yoga tradition. And that's essentially what we're going to be doing right now. So please put your hands on your lower belly, on your lower abdomen. I like to measure this place by putting my thumbs over the belly button and making a cup around that little protrusion of the lower belly below the navel. And begin to inhale with the feeling that the diaphragm is flowing downward towards the lower belly so that the lower belly expands a little bit on the inhalation. And then as you exhale, draw the lower belly, the lower abdomen back towards the spine, or you know, you can actually do it by drawing the navel back towards the spine to expel the breath on the exhalation. So we'll do that a couple of times. Inhale, expanding the belly. Exhale, pushing the breath out fairly intensely by pulling the navel towards the spine. So just two more of those breaths. Big, long, slow, deep inhalation. Big, long, slow, full exhalation. One more time. And now we're going to do the Kapalabhati, which is a forceful pumping breath where you inhale and exhale very quickly. And we'll do this to a count of 10, and then we'll hold the breath for 5 counts. So it goes like this. I'm doing it fairly slowly. You can do it much more rapidly. And you can just practice it with me for a moment. And the pumping action should come from the lower belly. So when we first start learning this practice, as many of you know, there'll be a tendency for the shoulders to lift, for the chest to lift. You want to try and keep your attention. Remember, energy follows attention in the lower abdomen. And pump. Let the pumping action come from the abdomen and from, of course, the diaphragm. So we'll do one more sample pumping round, and then we'll do the hold, and then we'll do it as an official practice altogether. So take a big deep inhalation and exhale, and begin to inhale and exhale with the emphasis on the exhalation in this pumping way. And I will count. And now hold the breath. Inhale. Exhale. And once again. Now hold the breath to a count of 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Exhale. And then rest in the space at the end of the exhalation. and inhale. Exhale. We'll do this one more time. And inhale. Hold. Exhale. And just for a moment, rest in the space at the end of the exhalation. Just as long as you're comfortable, and let the breath return to its natural rhythm. So this is a form of Pratyahara Vidharana, the practice of forceful inhalation and exhalation with a slight hold at the end of it. There are different forms of this practice, including, of course, the bellows breath. And I should say that in order to really master this practice, there are a couple of things that are really important. One is that your sitting posture be stable. In other words, you want to do this with a very firm seated posture. The other thing I want to say is that to get the depth of the practice, you need to do it regularly, and you need to do it over a period of time such that you can start to recognize the effects that it has. And it's also very helpful, if you're going to do it as a regular practice, to get some instruction. And, of course, one of the gifts of our time is that we actually can learn some of these practices on YouTube, and we can learn them from pretty accomplished teachers. This is not a substitute for having a one-on-one practice with a pranayama expert, but in my experience, pranayama experts are kind of hard to find these days, and we can practice this if we do it lightly and for not too long and allow ourselves to really contemplate the effects of it. We can learn these practices and find them very helpful over a period of time. The particular form of pranayama that we're going to continue with today actually emphasizes not the lower belly and lungs, but the soft palate and the Ajna Chakra. And I want to explain a little bit about why the soft palate can be such an important point of focus for us. So yoga science, as you know, offers various maps and techniques for opening the portals to the inner world. And many of them start by focusing on a particular spot in the physical body. In the Christian mystical traditions, I've been very interested to learn, the physical heart is considered to be such a spot, and it is also in certain yogic traditions, though most of us, when we do heart-based meditation, meditate not on the physical heart, but on a point in the center of the chest, somewhat to the right of the physical heart. The Christian tradition, in emphasizing the physical heart, has a whole set of teachings about the physical heart being an organ of wisdom, which can yield teachings to us when we learn how to focus on it. In Raja Yoga, the main spots that we activate are the perineum, the navel, the heart center, which in some cases can be the physical heart, the base of the throat, the root of the tongue, the tip of the tongue, in some cases the middle of the tongue, the soft palate, the forehead, the space between the eyebrows, and the crown. And the soft palate is associated with the inner visionary sense, that is, the ability to perceive subtle forms. And, of course, it's also associated with some of the most important organs in the physical brain. The soft palate is near the base of the brain. It's very close to the limbic system. the thalamus, the hypothalamus, the pituitary gland. It also activates the brainstem, and we'll say more about that. So these are organs that regulate our stress reactions, a lot of our emotional life, some of the emotions connected with survival, like fear and hunger, and they also mediate our experience of the samskaras and vasanas, which are stored in parts of the subtle body that act through the brain and over which we normally have very little conscious control. So, you know, many of you have been sharing that you recognize this when some apparently trivial incident or memory sets off anger or grief, or when you just can't let go of a habit pattern. You know, the emotional hormones like serotonin and dopamine and norepinephrine, etc., and cortisol may look like they are responsible for these feelings, and many neuroscientists firmly believe that emotional reactions are basically chemical. In the yoga tradition, we would say that these, you know, the hormonal activity, the activity of the endocrine system, are actually the physical effects of the subtler mechanisms by which the samskaras are activated. Because the physical and subtle bodies of a human being are completely entwined. So when you do a highly targeted practice like the one we're about to do, it lets the subtle prana oxidize the particles of samskaras that form a veil over the Ajna center. Later on in the text, Patanjali says that the practice of pranayama removes the veils that hide the inner light from us. I mean, that they literally are practiced to remove these veils so that we can see the light that arises in the Ajna chakra. And any pranayama will have a psychoactive effect, but they're different for each of the pranayamas. And, you know, some are calming, some are heating, energizing, others cool the body, and then there are those that are cleansing. So we actually can do pranayama for stress release, for energy, for purification, and the same pranayama practiced with a different target and a different intention could equally well calm you, energize you, or help you let go of something that's making you feel bad. Even though the subtleties of these practices are very deep, and if you want to study pranayama from a book, I actually recommend Richard Rosen's book on the practice of pranayama, which is really great and full of terrific instructions, really clear instructions. But he doesn't describe this practice, which is actually quite esoteric. And we're going to do it first, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about what we learn about the Ajna chakra through doing this practice. So let's start by locating the soft palate. And you can do that by curling the tongue back and, you know, just running the tip of the tongue over the hard palate, you know, that bony part of the palate, and then bringing it back towards the back of the throat till you feel the softer part of the palate. Softer, that's why it's known as a soft palate. And what you can see here, or what you can feel here, is that the soft palate is really right next to the brainstem, right in front of the back of the throat. And it is also the seat of a subtle chakra called the Talu chakra, which literally means the palatal chakra, which is the lower part of the Ajna chakra. So the Talu chakra is within and slightly above the soft palate, and it kind of segues into the Ajna, which is in the middle of the head, just above and in, you know, just above the space between the eyebrows, which is not actually between the eyebrows, but about half an inch above the eyebrows. And if you find that place and go inward from there to the center of the head, you will find yourself in the Ajna Chakra, which will begin to feel, become more active as you do this particular practice. So let me explain what we're going to be doing, and then we'll do it together for a few minutes, and we'll take a little bit longer on this practice than we did in the last one, so that you can get a deeper sense of it. We're going to start with a long, soft inhalation through the nostrils, targeted or aimed at the soft palate. You know, the breath, of course, is an aspect of our psychophysical system that can be felt. The breath has a quality of touch in it. So as we inhale into the soft palate, you can begin to feel the breath flowing through the nostrils, the sensory experience of the breath flowing through the nostrils, flowing towards the back of the throat, and, so to speak, hitting or touching the soft palate. So see if you can feel that. As we inhale, we're going to accompany the inhalation with the sound hum. And then we'll hold the breath for a count of four. If that's too long for you, you can hold it for less. Or if you'd like to hold it for longer, you're free to do that. But I'll count to four. And then we'll do a soft exhale with sa, allowing the breath simply to flow through the whole space of the head. The breath, the inhalation and exhalation should be soft. There is a version of this practice where you actually do it with the pumping motion, the prachardana motion of forceful breathing, but tonight we're going to do it as a soft breath. So find your posture. Make sure that you're seated very firmly, feeling the weight of the sitting bones against your seat, and feeling the shoulder blades releasing onto the back, the chest lifting and opening. That's very important. Sense the crown of the head moving towards the ceiling. And then as you begin, make a very, not forceful, but clear effort to relax the shoulders. It's a kind of effortless effort. Just tell the shoulders to soften. Ask the throat to soften. Soften the forehead. Soften the cheekbones. And you might want to reestablish the softening in the shoulders, the neck, the face, and the crown of the head at different points in the practice. We'll begin with an inhalation into the soft palate. You might want to make a sound, not necessary, but accompany the inhalation with hum. Focusing on the soft palate and allowing the soft palate to receive the breath. And then with the exhalation, allow the sound sa to resonate through the head. And now, in the inhalation, touching the soft palate with hum, and then holding the breath there, allowing yourself to feel the energy there for just this long. And then with the exhalation, feel the energy of this region flowing throughout the head as you think sa. Again, inhale with hum. Hold. Feel the energy there. Exhale with sa. Now on your own, inhaling a long, smooth breath, letting it touch the soft palate with hum, holding it for 4 heartbeats, just long enough to actually sense the energy in that part of the body. And then exhaling, allowing the breath to flow through the whole region of the head with sa. Now, as you settle into this practice, see if you can notice that in the region of the soft palate, as you allow the breath to activate it, you can begin to sense a kind of luminosity. A sense of light. It might be very faint and dim. For some of you, it may be quite bright. I'm going to suggest that you create an intention to be aware of the light that starts to dawn as the breath activates the soft palate. Use the period of the pause to sense the presence of energy and light there. And then with the exhalation and the sound sa, see if you can merge your entire mind and sense of being in the sense of the presence within the soft palate. If you're feeling buzzy and spacey, just see if you can experience that buzziness as what it is, which is actually a sign that your Ajna Chakra, your command center, is starting to be activated to open. Long, soft inhalation focused on the soft palate. Hold. Long, soft exhalation, allowing the energy and luminosity of that region to just gently spread through the head in a very relaxed way. And if you need to, soften your shoulders, soften your face. That's really good. As you anchor this, your mind in this practice, there is actually a kind of gathering quiet that starts to come about. And if you do it over time, you will find that it's actually a very good practice for energizing the limbic system, helps improve memory. But the yogic purpose of it is to awaken your sense of the inner light that's present in this region, which may initially be experienced not visually, but as a sense of subtle touch or subtle presence or subtle sensuality that moves in this region, giving you a sense of ease and clarity that actually will gradually put the mind at ease. In book 2, Patanjali says that, as I said earlier, we practice pranayama in order to remove the veils that create dullness and cloudiness and actual darkness and keep us from being energized by that illumination, that Jyotismata, that is actually the substratum of our, not only our mind, but of our entire body. So most of us, when we close our eyes, see a fairly dark inner screen. Maybe it's grayish, often with little points of light in it. For some of you, it's blue, sometimes a pale sort of bluish, sometimes for some of you, deeper blue. And in general, the more pure your mind becomes or the deeper you are in meditation, the lighter that inner field, and eventually you do begin to sense luminosity in that space. And as you meditate there, especially when the Shakti is high, you are likely to sense the presence of subtle forms in the center. One of my experiences when I'm meditating in this way is that at a certain point, a blue eye, E-Y-E, will appear in the center of my head. Sometimes it's like a human, about the size of a human eye, sometimes larger. Sometimes it's small, like about the size of an elephant's eye. And I realize when I see this light, that the name third eye for this chakra is not casual, because this vision of an eye, which actually indicates that your inner subtle vision, your subtle sense of vision, which is one of the subtle senses, that one of the subtle powers that we all have, you know, these senses which become active in meditation and start to show us what my guru used to call the wonders of the inner world, which is indeed filled with really extraordinary experiences that we can perceive, we start to be able to perceive as the inner senses come online. These are forms of our superpowers, our basic superpowers, and these physical places, the soft palate, which is a portal into the Ajna Chakra, is one of the ways that we can cultivate entering into the Ajna through our ordinary physical body. And it's actually very powerful, and not just will not, if you do this for a while, it will not just open your experience of the Ajna, it will make it extremely accessible to you anytime, all the time, and as a result, open a level of intuition that is not necessarily accessible to us in ordinary states. Some of the other forms that you may see as your subtle visual senses is activated is a soft circle of white or bluish light, or in some cases a sparkling point of blue or white light, which is called the bindu. My guru used to call it the blue pearl, and he would say that it is a form of the divine, a form of God, a form in which the soul appears. And it's located there in this center, in this chakra. And there are other forms, which as this chakra gets activated, the forms may be vague and indistinct at first. They may come and go. The blue pearl notoriously appears in a flash and then disappears. But as you concentrate there, as the mind relaxes, there is a sense of sinking deeper and deeper, expanding and releasing into the subtlest layers of yourself. So one of the things that begins to happen here and in the heart center, which is where we're going to meditate in a little while, one of the things that starts to happen as you enter into your own light body, because that is what we're doing when we activate this center. And of course, we generally can't do this in 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 4 minutes or 5 minutes. We generally have to allow ourselves to sit in it for a while. And what begins to happen is that a luminous inner body starts to reveal itself in the space between the Ajna and the Muladhara. And your sense of entering into this luminosity may feel more like a sensation or more like a expansion of prana or a feeling than a vision. But it feels as though your inner body expands past the physical boundary, sometimes a couple of inches, sometimes a few feet. Because what happens as you begin to activate your light body is that you realize that the physical body is actually inside the light body. The physical body is not the boundary of your individuality. This subtle body, the luminous light body, is the body of your individuality, of which the physical body is an outgrowth, is an aspect. So in the next sutra, Sutra 135, Patanjali describes a practice of using the forms that arise from within as our concentration. And throughout this part of the text, when the sutras speak about absorption in different types of concentration objects, they talk a lot about the difference between meditating on an external form, you know, which would be a candle flame or a deity form or a mandala or a tree or the ocean or the sun or the moon. Many, many of the forms in nature are really terrific anchors for meditation. But the inner forms, the ones that this sutra is referring to, actually arise spontaneously in the course of meditation. And when we can focus on them and concentrate on them, they will very easily dissolve the mind into the subtler layers of itself in a process that is often called laya. Laya means dissolution, and those of you who have took the last Shiva Sutras course with me might recognize that this sutra actually relates to some of the Anava Upaya visual practices that we studied in that class. So many of the tantric visualizations that we might practice, including chakra visualizations, deity visualizations, are actually based on light forms that exist inside the subtle body. And these include the archetypal forms that appear in dreams and visions. If you're, as some of you are, if you've done active imagination in the Jungian tradition, you may have practiced with visualizing archetypal humanoid forms. This sutra refers particularly to yogic forms, which are often geometric. So for instance, a six-pointed star, the triangle, which might point upward or downward, the bindu or the blue point, the thumb-sized luminosity that takes the form of a flame, the circle or square with rays or petals emanating from a center. These are some of the forms that are really there, that appear in front of our inner eye as the Ajna Chakra begins to open. And, you know, what this means is that when we are practicing visualizing a chakra or the flame in the heart, we're actually invoking something that's already there. So the visualization, the formal visualization, is meant to activate that form so you can have an actual direct experience of it. But in this practice, which uses the pranayama, the idea of the pranayama, especially if we do the forceful inhalation, exhalation targeted at the Ajna Chakra, at the soft palate, is that what the pranayama does is actually remove the veil that keeps us from seeing the light that's already there. And for many of us, the first experience is of a kind of subtle circle of luminosity that may not be very bright, but which carries with it a very sweet feeling. And the thing is that very often when we have a visual in meditation, when we see something, we get all excited. We go, oh my God, I'm having an experience. Oh, this is so cool. Oh, let me hold on to it. And then it disappears. because we allowed the thinking mind to intervene in the experience. So what the sutra recommends is that rather than looking at an inner visual experience as a prize or as an achievement, that we see it as a hint that's arising from our inner being, from that particular chakra, and use it as a concentration object. The Sutteshvatara Upanishad describes some of the experiences you have as these centers open, and it says, during the period of yoga sadhana, one sees mist, smoke, fire, air, fireflies, lightning, crystal, and forms like the sun and the moon in the inner spaces. All these visions precede the light of God. So once again, see if you can allow the inhalation to flow upwards towards the soft palate with this feeling of sensually touching the soft palate with the breath, with the sound of hum. Hold for just a couple of seconds and be present with the feeling in that center. And then with the exhalation, allow the sound sa to expand the energy that you have activated there throughout the entire space of the head. And see if you can merge your sense of I-ness, your sense of self, with that feeling. For many of us, the luminosity of this center is experienced not so much as a light, but as a throb, as a pulsation, or as a feeling of expansion. And this is actually an experience of the foundational pulsation known as Shakti, which takes the form of the mind by condensing around thoughts that's become darkened by the accumulated samskaras. And as you allow this Shakti or Spanda, as it's often called, to become the focus of your attention, that sense of luminosity will often allow you to take rest in a very, very deep sense of yourself as presence. Not the egoic self-sense that arises here. We could call it the self-recognizing itself. And you begin to sense yourself as presence itself, as some people call this the authentic self, the self that aspires to the highest states of awareness and goodness and presence. So this practice of meditating on the inner sensations of light or pulsation begins more and more to connect you to your essence, to your core. One of the really interesting effects of meditating on the soft palate, which as we said is right next to the brainstem, is that this practice can begin to activate the essential qualities of the brainstem. You know, that the brainstem obviously is the home of what we call the lizard brain, which is where the amygdala, actually the amygdala is in the limbic system, but where the survival instincts, fight, flight, or freeze, get triggered, get activated. So there's a lot of fear in the brainstem. But behind the fear, beyond the fear, is a much deeper aspect of our capacity to survive. It is the absolutely clear intuition of what move to make, what to do next. In other words, hidden in the brainstem is the natural instinct for survival, which impels us into essential actions, actions that are necessary, that use the minimum amount of energy so that we don't waste energy, and which are absolutely wise and intelligent. The brainstem is the home of wisdom and intelligence that we have lost through civilization, but which begins to come online through meditations like this. So in the next sutra, 136, the original Sanskrit says Vishoka va Jyotismati, and Vyasa, the original sage of this, of who commented on this tradition, actually rewrites the sutra, which is really interesting, in order to bring out some of the esoteric qualities that the sutra is concealing, because this is, according to Pandit Rajmani, one of the most esoteric of all the sutras. You know, on the surface, Vishoka va Jyotismati, just, it basically means the state free from sorrow and anguish. You know, so, and obviously if we are in the state of sorrow and anguish that is infused with inner light, we tend to be calmer, we tend to not be so at the effect of our negative emotions. But this is what Vyasa says. He includes these extra phrases. By concentrating on the lotus of the heart, there arises a state of sorrowless joy, Vishoka, which is infused with inner light, Jyotishmati. And upon its emergence, such a state anchors the mind to a peaceful flow free of thought constructs. In other words, the heart opens and you take rest in one of the most delicious and anchoring aspects of your subtle self. So we're going to do this in a minute. I just want to say a few things about it before we start. You know, obviously meditation on the lotus of the heart is a core practice in not only in the yoga tradition, but in pretty much all the mystical traditions, including Christianity and Sufism. In modern times, the Christian meditation teacher, Father Thomas Keating, created a practice which he calls centering prayer, in which we meditate in the heart center. And the practice there is not to use a mantra, but to come up with a word which might be something like trust or presence or love or relax or let go, and just let your mind sink into the heart with the flavor of that word attached to it. And often people in his tradition say that when they begin practicing centering prayer, and you'll recognize this, a lot of samskaric burn-off arises. So, you know, you might feel all kinds of crazy stuff showing up when you first begin meditating in the heart, and which is not surprising. But gradually, little by little, as we stay with the practice and move through it, we come to the place behind the emotional heart, and that's where we find ourselves truly anchored in the inner self. One of the reasons that I wanted to use Pandit Rajmani's commentary is because of what he says in his commentary on this verse, and partly because I've spent many, many years meditating in the heart. It was my go-to practice from the beginning, and it's still my main starting point when I sit for meditation, even though these days I generally practice in a sort of a vertical meditative pattern as I start. But what I've found is that by sitting in the heart, by learning to really become present to the heart, my consciousness expands from there so that I'm not focused in the physical body, but instead anchored in the center of a luminous field that becomes wider and more expansive as meditation becomes stable. So it's the same luminous field that we enter through the Ajna, somehow when it's centered in the heart, it becomes a state that we can actually walk around in, because the heart is much more embodied than the ajna. And because the heart has several levels, when we learn how to take rest in the heart and to take rest in this expansive luminous body, we actually find ourselves having access to a level of intuition, which in Sanskrit is called pratibhayan, intuitive knowledge that will guide us unerringly if we can learn to tune into it and trust it. Again, as you know, the heart has several levels which interpenetrate each other. First, of course, the physical heart, which is not just a pump. It's a very sophisticated organ that has its own brain and its own wisdom. And in the technology called heart math, which is a really pretty sophisticated technology, which starts out with stress reduction, but which successfully uses meditation in the heart as a way to practice decision making that comes from a deeper and more intuitive place than the kind of decisions that we make when we're focused in the thinking part of the mind. Within the physical heart, there's the emotional heart, which, of course, is where all the upheavals that we experience emotionally are located. And in one of the Yoga Upanishads, it talks about how the soul revolves around the 12 petals of the heart lotus, the Anahata Chakra, and that on some of these petals there are qualities like love and friendliness, and other of the petals there are qualities like anger and depression, envy. So the point of the metaphor that this Upanishad uses indicates that when we're centered in the emotional heart, we do tend to go round and round between positive and negative emotions, more or less without being able to control them. And then there's the spiritual heart, which is the place we sink into through this meditation. And it's what Vyasa means when he talks about the lotus of the heart. And as you know, the lotus of the heart is a major image in all the traditions of South Asia and also East Asia. And it's considered to be the seat of the deity. So if you're a person who practices, in engagement with a personal form of the divine, you would characteristically seat the deity in the heart and experience yourself as sitting with the deity in the heart. And what Pandit Rajmani says, and this is my experience as well, and it is the experience of some of you because I've heard you speaking about it, is that when we're focused in the heart, we are very much able to be in contact with a sense of what I would call the divine other, the divine beloved, who as a being who is both within us and separate from us. I'll say more about that in a moment. And as we meditate in the spiritual heart, what will happen eventually is that the spiritual heart, which is an aspect of our individuality, will morph into the universal heart, the Hriday, as it's called, which is one of the names that the tantric sages like Abhinavagupta and others give to the supreme consciousness itself, which is said to be like a vast beating heart that emanates universes and draws them back into itself out of the quality that, of course, we most associate with the heart, which is love. So meditation on the heart has as its purpose, first of all, tuning us into our capacity for personal connection with the divine in form, but ultimately for allowing us to dissolve into the heart of awareness itself from a place that is infused with love. And one of the reasons that entering the space of supreme consciousness through the heart is so privileged and prioritized in so many traditions is because love is the best feeling in the world, as well as being the basic pulse of existence itself. So tuning into the Supreme through the heart, through a devotional practice, is profoundly satisfying to those of us who are who tend in that direction. So the lotus of the heart refers to the state of consciousness where the individual soul and the Supreme Soul are united, are together. In his commentary on one of the sutras in Book 3, Vyasa writes about this. In the city of Brahman, the human body, it's a beautiful idea that the human body is the city of Brahman, it's the city of the Absolute. There is a space. In that space is the lotus shrine. In the lotus shrine, there is direct spiritual wisdom, pratibhajnan, the knowledge that arises from the heart. By practicing meditation on that wisdom, one gains complete understanding of one's mind. Now, like the heart itself, this statement exists on several levels. When we're seated in the heart, we become able to look at the gyrations of our crazy mind, and our mind does continue to be fairly crazy for a long time, even after we've become seated in our authentic being. We're able to look at that ever-moving mind without identifying with every single movement or crazy idea or even insider wisdom. We become the heart itself. We become focused in the self, and then the activities of the mind become kind of playful. We can watch them. If you've ever been very deep in meditation and had thoughts going on kind of above the surface or beyond the surface, you know what this feels like. And it's one of the reasons why meditation can be very powerful, even if the mind is still active. When the Yoga Sutras say that meditation in the heart gives full knowledge of the mind, however, they're not just talking about being able to witness the mind, although that is an incredibly great thing. It also means that when you're seated in the heart, you begin to see, to realize, to know on the deepest level that your individual mind is not different from the great mind. In other words, your limited mind begins to expand and reveal itself as the creative mind of Shakti, the creative mind of consciousness itself. And this is the tantric realization, the absolute expansion of your individual consciousness, so that you no longer experience your consciousness as separate from the great consciousness itself. It's not that you've lost yourself in the vastness. It's that you're able to hold both these truths and to tune into the vastness when needed, bringing it into the experience of your individuality. So the state of the awakened heart is said in Sutra 2136 to be a state of Vishoka and Jyotishmata, joyful contentment and illumination, profound happiness, the happiness that arises for no reason whatsoever, completely independent of what's going on outside. And the light that you experience in this state is not, it's obviously not like a physical light. It's a light filled with subtle intelligence, and it's our access point for the collective wisdom, the ancestral wisdom, the wisdom of the human race, the wisdom of the earth, the wisdom of the cosmos. It's the place we go to access our deepest knowledge and intuition. And it also happens to be, the heart is a very interesting center because it contains both the highest wisdom and also our karmic storehouse, the collection of karmic impressions that are constantly manifesting as our present destiny as well as our future. So everything that we are, and everything that we have the potential to become is encoded in the heart and reveals itself as the center opens. And the purpose, the gift of the heart center is that we can realize that our true I-ness is not tied to the ego, but is actually indistinguishable from the great I, the primal awareness itself. So we're going to enter the heart in a very simple way. Close your eyes and firm your posture. And find the breath. And this time, though you may want to allow some awareness of the diaphragm pulling the breath in, feel that the inhalation draws the breath deeply into the region behind the sternum, in the very center of the body. And again, we'll inhale with the thought hum, allowing the sound hum to reverberate almost as an offering into the heart space. And exhale with the sound sa, feeling that the energy of the heart reverberates as a kind of subtle luminosity throughout the whole chest region. Have the feeling that as you inhale with hung, you are opening your heart to the presence of the personal divinity, of that being, that inner guide, who is the beloved, who is always already there, who is seated in your heart. So with the inhalation, allow hum to be offered into the heart. With the exhalation, allow sa to expand the heart. And feel that the breath and the mantra are making you aware of the presence of the inner beloved, the inner friend, the inner deity, who is both yourself and paradoxically the divine other, the friend, protector, great mother, great father, divine lover. As you allow the breath to flow into the heart with a sense of deity presence within the heart, here's the instruction, which comes from my guru. He used to say, meditate on the one who is always meditating on you. Don't try to figure that out. Just take the instruction and notice that within the heart there is a presence who is fully aware of you in the most loving way possible. Who adores you, who sees you in all your splendor and in all your moments of darkness. Who never judges and whose only desire is to show you the beauty of what you are. To see if you can let yourself relax into this sense of presence in the heart. There's an extraordinary paradox about our lives in these bodies. And that is the paradox of our relationship to the divine self. Because that being whom we call the self, or whom we call God or goddess or guide or friend or beloved, is us. And is also an other. And how that can be is one of the great mysteries. In the Upanishads, there's a verse that says, two birds sit on a tree. One eats the fruit. The other looks on. And we could say that the individual, the egoic part of you, as it were, the small self, the limited self, which has, according to the Upanishadic tradition, its main seat in the heart, is always accompanied by the divine self, who throughout most of our karmic existence is felt as separate from us, but whom, as our practice matures, we come to realize is not an other at all, but our deepest self. And yet, many of the great beings, the great realizers who were non-dual realizers, who were completely soaked in absolute consciousness, nonetheless wrote devotional poetry to a divine other seated in the heart and often felt in the world itself. Rumi writes about the beloved in the heart. The great poet Saint Kabir, who lived in Varanasi in the 15th century, wrote, why should we two have to part? We live together, the great one and the little one. And even the non-dual tantrikas of Kashmir practiced heart-centered devotion and wrote exquisite poetry about their love for Shiva or Kali. And even though hardcore non-dualists believe that this is not an ultimate practice, I've found, and most practitioners find at some point, that at certain stages of practice, it's psychologically and spiritually necessary to cultivate a sense of the divine as a loving and protective other. Parent, friend, beloved. Kabir called that presence the friend. Rumi called it the beloved. And I know that for me, and for many of you, that the experience of an inner beloved with whom you're in relationship is very important for developing joy in your practice. And at a certain point, you start to recognize that you can merge your sense of being in that wider presence, and you become the beloved, you become the friend, you become the inner deity. So for a final round of meditation, a final entry into meditation for this evening, we're going to meditate on the beloved in the heart as Vishoka and Jyotismati, as a subtle sense of illumination, carrying with it a subtle sense of contentment, of joy. So as the breath flows in with hum, as it enters the heart, feel the breath touching this area behind the breastbone and kindling a feeling of softness, of tenderness, of acceptance inside the heart. As the breath rises and falls, flows into the heart with the inhalation and through the heart with the exhalation, as it flows with the feeling of hum sa, see if you can gently open to the fact that your heart is illuminated with a subtle crystalline light. Maybe it's soft and dim, maybe it's bright, or maybe it feels, maybe it's more of a sensation than a visualization. But its quality is clarity and presence and softness. Let your awareness become more and more settled into that sensation in the heart. The breath flows in, and with the exhalation, it expands through the whole chest. And you allow yourself to feel, this is me. Hum Sa, I am this presence. By meditating on the lotus of the heart, you activate the feeling of contentment and illumination. And as you let yourself fall into that feeling in the heart, the mind becomes soft and flows harmoniously and draws you deeper and deeper inside. May we be happy. May we be peaceful. May we be healthy. May we be free. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free. Namaste. So much love. Thank you.
asato ma tat gamaya tamaso ma jyotir gamaya mrityor ma mritam gamaya asato ma sat gamaya tamaso ma jyotir gamaya mrityor ma mritam gamaya om asato ma